This podcast was recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders past and present and recognise their continuous connection to culture. We would also like to thank the people of Norfolk Island, Aotearoa New Zealand and the Pacific for allowing their stories to be told.
I knew this affair only too well, from the inside, since I was the official tenant of the sailboat Uvea. I was supposed to be a young adventurer who didn't know how to spend his money. I've accepted this half-truth to this day, but it's true that my presence on board was no accident. In reality, I was the only link who, in the event of a crisis, would appear in his true identity, with all that it could imply.
So far in this epic tale, we've heard the perspectives of Kiwi cops, Norfolk Islanders, and Pacific activists. So what about a French point of view? And who better to give us that than one of the men from the Uvea? Despite the efforts of the French journos and their colleagues on the ground, I didn't have any luck raising Roland Verge, Gerald Andries, or Jean-Michel Bartolo. But I think I've got someone even more interesting, the fourth spy on the Uvea, Dr. Xavier Manigay, the risk-taking playboy. For more than 20 years after the bombing, Manigay denied all knowledge. But then, in 2007, something changed. He released a book called French Bomber, which goes into great detail about Operation Satanique and his role in it. The book was only published in French and isn't easy to track down nowadays. 2 years after he published this memoir, Manigay died in a plane crash in the French Alps, aged 62. Mireille, Manigay's partner for the last 15 years of his life, granted permission to use his book and for an actor to give him a voice.
He was a very honourable man, and he said to me, if I had known that I was surrounded by unprofessional people, there would have been also a dead man. I would never have been involved in such an affair.
You shake your head, you think, oh, shit. Especially when it was sort of intimated that our governments were dictating the terms.
It could be a matter of acute embarrassment to the government if anything went wrong with the deal.
Everybody was worried about trade, and never mind that a man died. I thought the whole thing was really disgusting at the official level.
This is the sixth and final episode of Fallout, Spies on Norfolk Island, The Man with a Thousand Lives.
I flew to Noumea at the end of May 1985, carrying some rather sensitive equipment. In this case, underwater detonators, which I still wonder why they didn't leave with the rest. At the time, there was no metal detector, nor a dog or explosive scanner.
Manigay's been part of the DGSE's action service since the 1970s. His partner, Mireille, tells me about some of his other missions.
He freed hostages in Somalia. He seized cocaine for the French government. And at the same time, he was operating in Angkor Wat in Cambodia, in monuments to demine all the sites.
In case you didn't catch that, Mireille's talking about Manigay's landmine removal work in Cambodia. In May 1985, Manigay arrives in Noumea, New Caledonia. He meets Verge, Bartolo and Andries for the first time. Verge has been working hard to make the Uvea fit for purpose.
An excellent skipper. Raymond had checked everything for 3 weeks. From the diesel engine taken out of its housing to be completely overhauled, to the port shroud boom cracked and replaced.
Bartolo, meanwhile, is taking food requests.
Spices and chocolate for me.
And preparing a menu plan.
He's right. Depressed morale always comes through the stomach.
The crew set sail from Noumea and head south in worsening conditions towards Norfolk Island. On Monday, June 17, 1985, they spot land ahead.
It can only be Norfolk, the nearest other island being 900 kilometres away.
The locals have already noticed the presence of this strange yacht.
Cars follow us from the shore. We go towards the harbour called Cascade Bay. The place looks superb, with very tall conifers scattered over pastures or stopping on steep cliffs. We approach a small jetty where about 20 fishermen and onlookers gathered. We drop anchors about 50 metres away. We reach the island aboard the Zodiac, which serves as our tender.
Their welcome is a warm one.
A plainclothes customs officer approaches us to announce that since it is Queen's birthday, he won't be able to complete the formalities until the next day. He takes us to a village where the shops are closed, but where we can still find a place to rent a car. I choose an inn, a little out of the way, which still is welcoming, and we return to our anchorage to collect things and check everything is okay before night.
When they get back to Cascade, Manigay sees something that makes him uneasy.
A sailboat, similar to ours, anchored cables away. As we get closer with the dinghy, waiting for a sign of life from our neighbours, we make a little noise to get them to show up, but nothing. Maybe they are asleep, or maybe they have disembarked very quickly, because we haven't been gone for long. I don't like this, even if my crewmates take it in stride.
Three of the men head back into town for dinner. Manigay gives what's, at best, a mixed TripAdvisor review.
The music and female clientele are outdated. No nightclub, but still that friendly pub atmosphere that reigns in Anglo-Saxon public places. Surely sad to live in, it's nonetheless superb. It looks like a piece of Switzerland, parachuted into the middle of the Pacific.
One local who appears to have made a good impression has to be Rona Robinson. We met her in an earlier episode when she told us about serving the flirtatious Frenchman while working as a waitress at her mum's restaurant.
We are stocked up on oranges, bananas and various fruit offered by a restaurateur and her charming daughter.
They are so charming. Charming pant socks. The whole three of us, mum, me and Lee.
When they get back to the Uvaya, Manigay resumes his focus on the mysterious yacht that's moored close by. He thinks it's extremely odd to have two similar yachts turn up in the same remote place at the same time in the middle of the southern winter.
The sloop presented no particular features apart from a radio antenna and the absence of any flag.
It's the first mention of a recurring theme in Manigay's book, his suspicion that someone, perhaps a rival intelligence agency, is keeping tabs on them. The Frenchmen leave Norfolk at nightfall and sail into black weather.
June 21. The shrouds are snapping and the masts are roaring in the wind, reminding me that this sea is the Tasman Sea, the one from Moby Dick and other maritime tales that I devoured with passion when I was a kid.
When it's Manigay's turn for night watch, he takes his Walkman for company.
I immerse myself in music. My headphones protected under the hood of the raincoat. I listen to Puccini.
As they near New Zealand, the weather worsens.
We're lying down, still on the starboard side. Half the deck under the wave, the cockpit carefully closed over to avoid taking on too much water. I'm worried about the ship. We are an essential link, and if our cargo doesn't arrive safely, we will have failed not only the boat, but also the entire mission.
They need to find dry land, and fast.
There are no harbours within a day's sailing, but Roland assures me there's a fjord, which should do the trick just behind the cape. He pulls out an old map drawn up by an Englishman at the end of the 19th century, still sold today for this part of the globe, where a mysterious Parengarenga Harbour can indeed be seen amidst the scribbles. But then there's the matter of finding a channel to get there.
Parengarenga, on the northern tip of New Zealand's North Island, is a graveyard for yachts due to the sandbar blocking entry. Skipper Verge decides to use the big storm swell to his advantage. They're going to surf over the sandbar.
It's my turn to be at the helm, and I point out to Roland that all the depths indicated around me here are very shallow. He seems confident, so I follow the headings he gives me. After an hour of approaching parallel to the coast, I make a 90-degree right turn directly onto a bar. Just before reaching the enormous wave breaking on the other side, I go to full throttle. The boat climbs at full speed, a few intense seconds during which the sailboat surfs the top of the wave. We have time to make out a flat bay with very distant sandy contours, without trees, without houses, without any signs of life. We make 7 or 8 jumps like this, using the engine to follow the wave as far as possible. Each time the miracle begins again, it holds despite this monstrous pounding.
Eventually, they moor at a pontoon in the harbour. The four men and the all-important Limpet Mines have made it to New Zealand. The mission goes on. The next day, the Frenchmen sail for a proper port and are cleared by customs. Time to let off some steam.
We dine at the Aloha Motel, where we behave like sailors.
Manigay's up front about his love for the thrill of the chase when it comes to the opposite sex.
I'm well aware that our presence at this time of year is somewhat strange, and I must therefore justify it with a certain frivolity. It is therefore essential that we behave like bachelors under 40, happy to live and relax in a small port after the storm. Here too, I believe, that we fulfilled our role perfectly, a part of the mission that was not, I admit, the most difficult.
Manigay's partner, Mirai, again.
It was before my reign, because there's a lot of ladies who remember very well exactly.
We know what happens after this. The Uvea crew deliver the explosives. The Rainbow Warrior is sunk, and tragically, Fernando Pereira is killed. The Uvea leaves Auckland on July 9, a day before the bombing. The crew have no idea how badly their operation has played out, or that they are wanted men. On board the Uvea, Dr. Xavier Manigay and his fellow crew battle treacherous conditions as they return to Norfolk Island. Winter really is a stupid time to be sailing in these parts.
Day breaks on the 11th on a very rough sea, with 40 knot winds blowing from the northwest. The barometer plummets and our speed drops to 4 knots. Headwind for a change, the boat is pitching like never before.
Manigay has only one thing on his mind as the storm rages.
The mission, the one and only reason we're going through this hell. How did it end? Did the boat sink as planned? Did everything go well? Are the others safe?
The GPS tells the crew they must be close to Norfolk Island. They turn the dial on the radio to try to pick up a news report, but can't lock onto a signal.
The summit of the island finally appears around 3 p.m. and we return to our anchorage at Cascade.
Manigay and Gerald Andres are rowing to shore in search of news when the doctor spots something.
Hey, Gerald, did you see the cop's car at the top of the cliff? He took our picture.
Manigay's heart sinks when he walks into the newsagent.
I see from afar that all the front pages show the same photo across 6 columns. I understand there's been a serious problem, a huge problem, since there's a victim.
Now, it's worth bearing in mind that we only have Manigay's version of events, written 22 years after the bombing, to go by here. I can't tell you how genuine his feeling of remorse is.
Realizing that you are part of an operation that contributed, even involuntarily, to the death of a civilian, not a personal enemy, is a very important moment in the life of a normal man, which you cannot forget or even ignore ever. I simply distribute the newspapers to my friends without comment.
Murray, Manigay's partner, says he carried regret for the rest of his life.
He was very upset, because he didn't want a man to be killed.
We all want a good shower, a dry bed, and some peace and quiet to take stock. We stay at the Pacific Hotel again and return to dine with our hostesses. They are surprised and happy to see us again, but the atmosphere is not right.
Manigay's instincts tell him they need to get off the island ASAP.
I urge my teammates to leave earlier for Noumea. Everything French is suspect, especially a certain missing sailboat. No doubt, if they think that we're dead, they'll soon learn we've been resurrected off Australia's Norfolk Island. As planned, I book a plane ticket to Australia, then help refuel the sailboat so it's ready to leave. I reach the airport at 3:15 for Sydney, and we say goodbye.
After spending a day in Sydney, Manigay tries to board his flight to Singapore. He's told the federal police are refusing his departure and put in a taxi to return to his hotel. Back at the same hotel, he's given a new room.
Very comfortable, and I lie down to think. No question of warning anyone. We're staying cool. I have to play solo, and above all, I mustn't forget that I'm a tourist who sees nothing and who hasn't understood anything. In the meantime, I decide to go to the French consulate just to inform them that a French national seems to be of interest to the federal police for unknown reasons. Nothing more. There's no question of calling the house, like a child calling its mother. They wouldn't be able to do anything anyway.
The house is his colloquial term for DGSE headquarters. Manigay goes for a walk and checks the reflections in shop windows for a tail. Back in his room, he takes a bath and turns on the TV news.
I suddenly seem to hear the words sailboat, French, and especially Ouvea. I jump out of the bath and stand there in front of the screen, dripping into the carpet. In shadow, the supposed profile of the Ouvea. According to the commentary, the sailboat Ouvea was seen near the Rainbow Warrior at the time of the attack. It belongs to a company that knows people in favor of nuclear testing, and this whole affair was sponsored by the New Caledonian far right. The hardest part for me is yet to come. The TV news anchor, summarizing the whole affair, picks up the headline I'd missed in the local newspaper. The French bomber is supposed to be in Sydney.
Alert but not alarmed, Manigay goes to the movies and, by coincidence, as he wrote in his book, happens to sit next to French government delegate Pierre Roussel. I've always been sceptical of this coincidence, but Manigay says it's just that. Roussel passed away a long time ago, so I can't ask him.
During the intermission, I leave with my two neighbours, but before I can exchange a few words with them, I am accosted by a burly redhead. Police, would you like to follow us? He says, showing me his badge. I find myself in the back of a large American car, wedged between a New Zealand police officer and an Australian police officer.
The car cruises through Sydney towards the Federal Police headquarters, where Manigay is taken to an interrogation room.
I'm facing a small metal desk with a second-hand typewriter, sitting on top of it, behind which New Zealand Detective Crossman, dressed to the nines in a suit with slightly skimpy vest, flops down.
Two Australian police are also there to ensure nothing untoward happens. Manigay pulls out a notebook with times and dates of his recent trip to New Zealand to help him answer the questions. He sticks to his cover story of the Playboy tourist who's hired a yacht and a crew for an adventure. A chess game of sorts is underway between Manigay and Kiwi Detective Crossman, who the Frenchman writes about in a rather condescending way.
When he tells me that my fingerprints were found on some equipment found under a bridge, I know he is lying, because I had taken care to handle all the sensitive equipment with inside-outside leather gloves we used for maneuvers. As for the gear found under a bridge, I dare hope that's also a bluff. In case of doubt, from now on I'll assume he's lying all the time. They'll find nothing but coincidences, chance events, but never any proof.
Crossman leaves the room to call his boss in Auckland. The Kiwi returns, takes off his jacket, and asks more questions.
When did you meet your crewmates? What conversations did you have together? We have good reason to believe that your crewmates were very closely involved in the explosion of the Rainbow Warrior. This is a very serious matter. There was one death in this attack. Your collaboration is extremely important. The dead man, unfortunately, I know only too well, exists. And I understand their determination to find the culprits. No confession, however, will resurrect the victim. That would only add to the mess and would be a pure betrayal of the mission.
At 5 a.m, Manigay is asked if he'll agree to give his fingerprints. The Australians interrupt to remind him he doesn't have to, as he's not under arrest.
I can't believe it, and I'm beginning to wonder if Anglo-Saxon law might be more respectful of the suspect's rights than French law.
Manigay returns to his hotel room for some sleep and breakfast. He's packing for the airport when there's a knock on the door. It's the Kiwi detective Crossman and another officer. Crossman invites him to the hotel bar for a no hard feelings morning beer. Manigay recognises the gesture for what it is, a desperate attempt to get his prints on the beer glass.
Thank you, but I'm in a hurry. My plane is leaving soon.
Despite his protests, he's chaperoned to the hotel bar.
My beer is waiting for me, immaculate, just the right amount of foam. Well-mannered, I reply, "Cheers, gentlemen. Long live Australian beer." I put the glass down while mechanically sliding my tightly clenched fingers from the rim of the glass to the bottom and swirling it around. Good luck with the fingerprints, you bunch of fakes.
This time, Manigay makes it to Singapore. During the 8-hour flight, his mind turns to how he ended up in this predicament. Unbelievable mistakes made by his captured colleagues.
The Tarange couple's phone calls from their hotels to ours, when it was so easy to use the phone booths, as all spies around the world have always done since phone booths have existed. Indeed, the New Zealand sleuths didn't even have to consult the hotel switchboard records, since the notes, including those of the phone calls, were exhaustively compiled in chronological order in a bundle found in the couple's luggage for later reimbursement by the Parisian administration. Dates, times, numbers, receipts, durations, everything was there, ready to use, enough to make you cry.
His partner, Mireille, tells me Manigay, a part-time spy, felt let down by his full-time colleagues.
He was sent in a place with unprofessional people because he was a secret agent of reserve. You know, he was not all the time. He thought the professionals were more professional than him, and he said, wow, I can't believe that.
Manigay arrives home in Paris feeling uneasy about his future. His sense of betrayal building, he goes into hiding. The police, the press, and his own government are coming after him and his colleagues when, in their eyes, they were simply following orders. Mireille tells me that it's important to consider the French perspective at this point in time. Having been occupied by Hitler's Nazis 40 years earlier, France considered its nuclear arsenal vital to its ongoing security.
We have to see that Greenpeace was not the gentle and very nice anti-whale sector, which is now. But it was an organization during the Cold War. It was very much against French interest all over the world, especially in strategic points.
Manigay's told to present to Bernard Tricot, the public servant investigating any DGSE involvement in the Rainbow Warrior bombing. He's ordered to attend another interview with Kiwi officers in Paris. During the interview, he sees a photo that adds to his suspicion that he and his Uvea compatriots have been watched by someone from the get-go.
It's me, sitting in the back of the Uvea with my Walkman on my ears. I easily remembered where it had been taken while the sailboat was docked in Opua, the day after the customs officer visit. This photo had been taken with a telephoto lens by a third party.
He wonders about the mysterious yacht that turned up next to theirs at Norfolk Island.
Is it possible that this sailboat could have followed ours while staying out of sight thanks to high-performance radar?
Manigay's far more troubled when he learns one of the DGSE's own is talking. In September 1985, he meets the editor of a prominent Parisian magazine who lets him know an anonymous but well-informed dossier is being hawked around the city's media circles.
What I read appalled me. Over several pages, names, pseudonyms, descriptions of equipment, dates, accounts of precise circumstances, all true.
He immediately calls DGSE head office to let them know they have a problem.
A snitch is the traitor from within, an informer from within. The man who betrays his brothers in arms and their shared principles. He is the one no one suspects and who strikes in the back.
Time passes, but soon secret information that worries Manigay appears in a new book called Operation Oxygen, written by Patrick Dumont-Ver, a pseudonym used by the author, Patrick Amery. This is the book French broadcaster Hervé Brussini told us about in the previous episode. As Manigay flicks through the pages, he realises the leak is very close to home.
I quickly discover that the Uvea Odyssey is treated in a curiously personal, very concerned way, as if the narrator had taken his sources directly from one of the four teammates.
Manigay is certain one of Verge, Bartolot or Andries has briefed the author on everything.
One thing he spoke in his book, and I don't know who he is, he speaks of somebody in his team who betrayed.
And whoever it is doesn't like him very much.
A certain malevolence, indeed, welled up against me throughout the chapters, which could only come from someone who knew me during the mission, and even more specifically, aboard the sailboat.
He rules Verge out when a situation on board the yacht that just involved him, Andries and Bartolo is described in detail. Then he finds it. The passage in Operation Oxygen that disturbs Manigay so much refers to his desperation to get news of how their mission played out when they returned to Norfolk.
It's Andries who accompanies me in the dinghy. We are alone. We barely haul off the anchored sailboat when I inform Andries of the presence at the top of the cliff of a policeman who is watching us with binoculars and photographing us. This episode is described in detail, and the icing on the cake in the story, it's Andries who sees the policeman and informs me. This time, there's no doubt about it. The informant is a crew member from Uvea, and it's Andries.
I want to make it clear that I'm not suggesting Andries was leaking to the author of Operation Oxygen. What you're hearing is Manigay's informed deducement. It's worth knowing that France's National Audiovisual Institute, which has the clip of the interview with the agent, identifies the man sitting with his back to camera as Gerald Andries. Unfortunately, I've not been able to find Andries to ask him about any of this. While we're talking about Andries, Maurice Witham told me he was the one they came closest to catching, 6 years after the bombing.
In 1991, Gerald Andres goes to Basel in Switzerland without a passport or without an identity, and they do a check on him. In the meantime, I had laid international warrants to arrest, red cards, if you like, red alerts for the three. I was told I wasn't allowed to for Manigay because he gave his correct details. But the other three, we charged them with the murder and conspiracy and all that. He was arrested, and I got a ring at home one morning to say, oh, have you still got a warrant to arrest for this guy? Can you fax it to Switzerland? They want to hold him. We had very, very good evidence. He bought the outboard motor. He bought the Zodiac, instrumental in the bombing. And then in March 91, there'd been a meeting between the New Zealand government and the French government, and I was instructed, ordered, to withdraw the charges.
Where'd that order come from?
From the government to the police. So we had more evidence on Gerald Andres than we did on everyone else, anyone else.
Manigay claims Andres and Patrick Amery, the author behind the pseudonym, had been friends since adolescence. He also writes that Andres was briefly jailed for making DGSE secrets public. I've not found any proof of this, although I can't imagine the DGSE publicising such a thing if it happened. Hervé Brissini did tell me that the agent in his report was locked up.
But after, when he was free again after the jail, I don't have any news from him.
For what it's worth, I found a 40-page extract of Operation Oxygen online. The translated version was fascinating reading, especially about the activities of the Uvea and her crew. How much is true is anyone's guess, given the author's post-publication claim that it was fiction based on real events once the legal threats started to roll in. I asked Murray, who still lives in the home she shared with Manigay in Normandy, to sum him up.
He was a man with 1,000 lives. If you dig, he was a very sensitive man and very concerned by the welfare of the others. And of course, if you become a secret agent, you've got a certain sense of idealism.
I'll leave it to Xavier Manigay, diver, pilot, sailor, shark expert, lover, medicine man, and spy, to close his chapter.
Man has spied on his potential adversaries ever since he was on Earth, as much to prevent an attack as to prepare for one.
Have you seen one of these?
Former Kiwi detective Chris Martin's showing me a dirt-covered metal object that's been fashioned onto a wooden plaque.
This was in a box for about 30 years, and my son, he got sick of seeing it, so he actually got a piece of walnut and mounted it up and did everything. But that's the piece of the Rainbow Warrior.
Wow.
It's a belaying pin.
The pin is used to secure rigging on sailboats.
And it was, the Greenpeace at the end of the inquiry gave us about half a dozen of these. And some of the guys got these bronzed and things. And I offer, that's the actual mud or Falkland Harbour when the boat was found. Tried to keep it sort of as original as possible.
That's a piece of history right there.
Yeah.
It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Morris said this too about sometimes protest groups, activist groups and police don't always see eye to eye.
No.
But it seems like you and the crew you're here like have formed like almost like a lifelong kind of bond.
It is, yeah, no, surprisingly so. And the interest, you know, if we're coming up for 40 years since all this happened, is still really strong. You know, it's people want to talk about it. Young people hear about it and they're just disbelieving that, you know, a country like France could come into a little peaceful harbour like New Zealand and blow up a boat. You know, mate, that's so uncool. So this was way outside anything any of us had ever experienced. I mean, to think 40 years on, you're sitting here in my house asking me questions about it, and it just shows how big it was.
Maurice Witham is well into retirement, but there's a fire inside him about what could have been. especially if things went differently on Norfolk Island.
The word terrorism wasn't a word in those days, but to think about acting as terrorists in New Zealand, blowing up a ship, for goodness sake, in a port, in Auckland, in a friendly port, and, you know, and the death of the man Pereira, Fernando Pereira, it's pretty hard, you know, that they could do everything contrary to the law, and we were confined by a minor point of the law.
Had the Kiwi police been able to bring Verge, Bartolo, Andries, and possibly Manigay back to Auckland to face charges, New Zealand would have had a far stronger hand to deal with the economic pressure from France. But that tight deadline set by Australia stood in the way.
Just hold them there for another, probably 24, 48 would have been enough. We were that close. That's the way the law falls, and for us as investigators, we put a lot of work into it. You have to take the good with the bad. The dice fell their way. Game over.
Fallout, Spies on Norfolk Island, is an SBS audio production and was created, written and hosted by me, Richard Baker. Produced by Liz Burnett. Sound design and mix by Max Gosford. Executive producer is Joel Supple. Artwork by Paolo Lim. With thanks to the people of Norfolk Island for sharing their stories, especially Kissard, his wife Sue and Russell Francis for making me feel welcome and connecting me with people. If you wish to contact me with any story tips or feedback, please email fallout@sbs.com.au.